Hi, and welcome to another episode of Economist Corner, a CETA podcast where leading economists break down the latest news and policy updates. I'm Melinda Salento, Chief Executive of CETA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. It's a day since the polls closed in the US presidential election, and it is turning out to be an absolute nail-biter, with the results unlikely to be known for days. Despite the uncertainty of a long and bitter election campaign and the ravages of COVID-19, the US economy has just posted its biggest quarterly growth on record, a stunning rebound out of recession. Who knows? Quite simply, it's a time of enormous upheaval in the world's biggest economy. To discuss this and more, I'm joined by Wendy Edelberg. She's a senior fellow in economic studies at the US-based think tank, the Brookings Institution. She's also director of its economic policy arm, the Hamilton Project. So, Wendy, welcome and thank you for joining us in this conversation today. At CETA, we look for policy solutions that deliver better economic and social outcomes for the greater good in Australia. And really, we're very focused on how you can create as many opportunities for Australians to connect to the benefits of economic growth as possible. And I think there's some strong parallels with the goals of the Hamilton Project, where, as far as I can tell, you work to develop policies that create an economy that benefits more Americans. Do you want to just tell me a little bit more about the work you do at the Hamilton Project?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that there are a lot of parallels. Those are very much our goals. The way we try to achieve those goals is by tapping all of the just immense expertise that's out there in academia and among other experts, you know, in economics and in the policy world, who have been thinking analytically about issues for a long time and probably have been thinking about solutions to the analytical challenges that they've been studying. But that's not really a typical thing that an academic does to suggest policy solutions. They, generally speaking, stop short of making those kinds of suggestions. So we offer them an outlet to do just that. So we go out in the world, we find an academic who is just incredibly knowledgeable about a particular challenge in the economy where changes to fiscal policy could help address that challenge. And we encourage them to bring all of those analytical skills to bear and suggest policy options for, you know, that policymakers can truly act on, really actionable ideas.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. Prior to me joining CETA, I worked for an organization called the Productivity Commission, and it was one of the great conversations we used to have around the table there, which is, you know, it's great to produce fantastic ideas and do all the good research, but, you know, who's focusing on how to get them implemented and the practical, pragmatic things that policymakers and politicians can actually pick up and implement? Let me just ask you a question. I mean, there's so much focus now on, you know, I'm going to use this overused phrase, but fake news. And I think sitting alongside of that is this great challenge of getting evidence into conversations. It's one of the things that I think people are talking quite a bit about now, particularly people like you and I who try to influence policy for the good, if I can put it that way. How are you thinking about actually trying to raise the voice of your solutions and to have them become more impactful?
So I think you're right that the environment has become more challenging, that people are, there are some people who are, for example, questioning statistical agencies like U.S. statistical agencies that just do incredibly important work just, you know, with integrity through and through. And yet, you know, people are even questioning those agencies and, you know, whether or not they're trustworthy. So certainly the environment has changed and become challenging on that front. That said, I think policymakers and people in the policy community are still very, very hungry for this kind of analytical rigor that I'm hoping that the Hamilton Project brings to bear. We don't really have to make a terribly hard sell to motivate you know, why somebody should come to a Hamilton Project proposal to see these ideas presented with analytical rigor. The people who are making the decisions are still often quite interested in that. They may disagree with it. They may set it aside. They may not be persuaded, but there is still very much a robust audience for that kind of analysis in Washington, D.C. Well, look, Wendy, you've had the great opportunity to advise two presidents, Bush and Obama, when you were executive director, and you were also executive director of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. You worked in the Congressional Budget Office. I'm really interested in how you think this administration and the president have handled the current crisis, both the COVID crisis, but also, of course, the parallel economic crisis in the US. Well, I have a bunch of thoughts and a bunch of reactions. I should say, you know, what I can offer is a reaction to the general policy environment. I have less of a really good critical sense of how much of my, you know, where I see my frustrations, how much of that is attributable to this presidential administration, how much of that is attributable to the Senate, to the House, or to other actions. But so I can't parse it that way in a political sense, but I can certainly tell you that I'm quite frustrated. I mean, okay, let me start with the good news. The good news is that Congress did this great thing, passing incredibly large and effective and fast fiscal relief in the CARES Act very quickly and very early in the crisis. And that was just incredibly helpful. And really, to their credit, and a great thing. And of course, the president signed it. So that was all good and was really important in supporting the economy. But every observer, I'd be puzzled to find an observer who didn't agree that the federal response to the pandemic has been frustrating. We clearly could have done a better job keeping the pandemic under control and doing more effective, taking more effective measures in limiting its spread. I mean, you look at other countries, and a bunch of other countries have done a whole lot better than we have. And the idea that masks have become political is just mind-boggling. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's just a quintessentially American thing that, like, we can make something like that like a political pawn. But of course, we need to get the pandemic under control. The fact that it's resurging right now is not particularly surprising. Just about everybody's economic forecast we're in the fourth quarter, we're entering, we're very soon going to be in the first quarter of 2021. Everybody who is doing economic forecasting was probably incorporating a high probability of a resurgence as the weather got cold. So it's not terribly surprising that that's happening. But of course, that doesn't mean that we've been responding perfectly effectively to it. And for sure, I am just wildly frustrated with the lack of action on the part of the federal government to pass more fiscal support for the economy. So our labor market is still really weak. We have hundreds of thousands of small businesses that are failing, like at three times the pace of, in a normal period. We have households that are just incredibly financially fragile right now. It is very frustrating. And we're seeing the economic growth slow. We are seeing the recovery slow, which is not surprising in the least bit, given the waning fiscal support and all of the other headwinds we face.
Yeah. I mean, I think you actually published a paper recently, looking for or outlining the sort of magnitude of fiscal stimulus that would actually bring the US economy back to its pre-COVID growth path, but sort of next year rather than years down the track. And I think it's really interesting. I think one of the things we're really grappling with at the moment is that you get these huge falls in activity and economic growth, but then they bounce back so quickly and you can kind of get a false sense of, oh, maybe we're back on track. But I think, you know, what you're saying is that the economy in the US remains still fundamentally very weak and looking like it's actually getting weaker. Do you want to talk just a little bit more about the scale of fiscal stimulus that you think is needed to bring the economy back to what would be a decent trajectory?
So the analysis I did with a colleague of mine at the Brookings Institution, her name is Louise Shaner. So Louise and I did this analysis of looking at some illustrative packages and how, if those all were put together in one large package, how it might affect aggregate demand and overall growth. So, and as you say, we found that a big package could lead to a much better projected path of GDP growth than otherwise. So we looked at five illustrative policies just for comparability. We made each one of them $400 billion. They obviously wouldn't all have to be the same amount. And in fact, in some of the cases, the policies were not that are being discussed right now fall short of the $400 billion. So that it was really meant to be illustrative. And so if all five policies were passed together, that would get you to a package of $2 trillion. And so the package spans, the illustrative package that we analyzed spans more money for unemployment insurance, more money simply to, you know, being sent to households, more relief for small businesses, relief for state and local governments, and then a handful of smaller things. And so each one of those sorts of policies would have a different kind of effect on the economy. So, for example, state and local governments would probably spend money more slowly than unemployed people. But, you know, nonetheless, those governments would spend the money, fully spend the money, but over what would be years instead of quarters.
Yeah.
And so we find that if all five of those were passed, but passed like now or like a month ago,
yeah,
that the GDP would go back to its pre-pandemic GDP path by the middle of next year. And as you say, the projection without any additional fiscal stimulus has GDP going back to its pre-pandemic path like in years and years from now. It is very depressing.
I think it is a really interesting challenge, isn't it? Because I think it's easy to sort of think, well, economic activity has fallen by 8%, you know, this quarter. So if it rises by 8% next quarter, we're back on track. But actually, that's not quite the case. And I think one of the conversations that we're having here in Australia as well is around the impact of the fiscal stimulus. We've had, like so many other countries, a huge amount of fiscal stimulus put into the economy. Of course, that brings its own challenges when it's withdrawn. So it's just such an interesting dilemma, I guess, how much into the economy, how soon, and, you know, what's going to hit the economy early and then what's going to keep it going down the track. Let's take a step back. I mean, you've spent a long time looking at fiscal policy, working for organizations like the Congressional Budget Office. Does the magnitude of spending and debt that's now being implemented or considered in the US and around the world, is that surprising to you? Is it something that you ever thought that you would sort of entertain as a policymaker?
Yeah, I mean, it's both surprising and it is something that I entertained. The part that's not surprising is that it makes perfect sense that in the face of, you know, what is really a cataclysmic shock that the world is facing right now with this pandemic, that in the face of such a large shock, there would be what would be appropriate would be a really large fiscal response. So the size of the fiscal response seems completely appropriate to me, and as we've just been talking about, I think it deserves a greater response than what we've already had. It's surprising in that it wasn't in my baseline, but pre-pandemic, but the possibility of bad outcomes, and you know, knowing that I would want policymakers to step up and act aggressively in response to bad outcomes. Those risks were always on the table.
Yeah. Do you think it's something we've learned a little bit from the financial crisis?
I hope so. But there are signs that we haven't completely learned, which are really frustrating. So, for example, we know that in the U.S. post-financial crisis, state and local governments in the U.S., because of the enormous budgetary shortfalls they were facing, state and local governments were a drag on the economy for years. So even as our economy was trying to get onto a better growth path, and there were lots of signs that the recovery was improving, state and local governments continued to be a headwind year after year after year. And the federal government did not do enough to support the state and local governments. There was, you know, this was when the U.S. in the U.S. Policy circles, there were arguments about, you know, whether or not we should be turning to austerity so quickly. And we did turn to austerity too quickly. Again, we have not done nearly enough for state and local governments. And yes, that is really frustrating. The other thing that I'm worrying that we haven't learned is that if we let our labor markets get into, you know, a place of bad structural outcomes, that is very slow to turn. So, sorry, what I just said probably didn't make any sense. But what I meant is, like, post-financial crisis in the U.S., we saw long-term unemployment go up really high. So there were just millions of people who had been employed, unemployed for months and months and months, and they found it really challenging to find employment after being out of work for so long. And we also saw that a lot of people just simply left the labor market. And it took, you know, it wasn't really until like 2019 that we finally had a hot enough labor market that we were seeing really good news on the labor force participation front. And you know, all signs are pointing to labor market outcomes that are as depressing as what we contended with post-financial crisis.
Yeah, and it's been a real focus here in Australia. You might find this a little bit funny, actually, but that we've got a whole range of measures here. We had subsidies to keep people in work while we were in lockdown. The thing I'm saying is you might find a little bit funny is we've got this program called JobKeeper, and then there's JobSeeker, and then there's JobTrainer, and then there's JobMaker. You might get the sense that our government's very focused on jobs.
Yeah.
Are policies like that being contemplated in the US? And I mean, there's actually now also been, you know, one of the programs is around providing wage subsidies for businesses that hire workers aged under 35. Right. So it's a real focus to prevent labour market scarring for young people. Is that part of the serious policy conversation in the US?
Yes. I mean, I don't think policymakers are as committed to it as they should be. And some of these efforts are, you know, more nascent. Like, so for example, we have a program where if a person is partially laid off, and I think I'm not using exactly the precise correct terminology, but if they're partially laid off, which is just to say if their hours are cut, then there is unemployment insurance that they can apply for. So they don't have to be fully laid off in a lot of states that are participating in order to get some unemployment insurance benefits. Very few businesses and very few people seem to be participating in that program. And so, like, there are these little pockets of hope that we're doing more along these lines, but like this program should be used, like, you know, tenfold more than it is currently being used to really be effective.
Wendy, if you could wave your magic wand and get the Senate to pass anything in, you know, overnight to sort of help the economy recover, what would it be?
It would be more unemployment insurance. It would be extending and expand. It's like right now, the way things are set up in the U.S., the really important expansions of our unemployment insurance system are set to expire at the end of this year. That would be catastrophic if that actually happens. So job one is extending all of those cutoffs well beyond the end of this year, and even better, tying the cutoffs or having a wind down that is tied to the state of the labor market, and making sure that unemployed people and that families that have unemployed people in them are financially secure. So making, you know, if that means sending them extra on top of their usual UI benefits, doing that too. So that's number one. Number two is, I think we still have evidence. We've made a lot of progress on food insecurity in this country in the past few months. We still have evidence that we haven't solved the problem created by the pandemic, the COVID recession. And so doing more on food security, getting out more what we used to call food stamps and now we call Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. I think I've got all the letters right. So expanding those benefits, like, that's a no-brainer. Do that. We need more. We need a lot more help for small businesses. That's complicated. And in fact, one of the economists who we reached out to write a proposal, the Hamilton Project reached out to write a proposal on how to support small businesses, is an Australian economist, just coincidentally, who's at George.
Well, we are fantastic, you know.
and so, we have policies that we can turn policymakers' attention to, but I appreciate that figuring out exactly how to support small businesses is complicated, but something needs to be done. And the last thing is, getting some fiscal relief to state and local governments. Those are the highest things on my list that just have to happen like yesterday.
Yeah, and you know, strong parallels to issues here in the Australian economy as well. Now I'm going to give you the segue to the election. I think one of the interesting things that's emerged as we're all sort of hanging on to the screens, wondering what next, is the extent to which the economy was a focus in the election. And I think one of the things certainly the commentators are starting to say around the Democratic campaign and Biden's campaign was, you know, was that enough of a focal point, or was he too focused on COVID, the health crisis, and not COVID, the economic crisis? What's your thoughts on that?
As much as I can, I'm going to completely sidestep whether or not
I'm putting you in the political
whether
spot,
or not
aren't I?
Biden or Trump were, you know, focused enough or focused too little on particular issues. But what I will say, which is hopefully enough of an answer, is that there's a lot of economic pain in this country, but it's caused not just by the COVID recession that has certainly exacerbated a lot of the pain. The economic inequality that we have been living with for a long time and has been getting worse and worse over time is just a national embarrassment. And it makes a lot of sense to me that the people who are frustrated at the lower ends of that terrible distribution of economic resources, that the people who are at the lower end of that are hopping mad. And they don't want, I mean, what do I know? I don't know what they want and what they don't want. But my guess is that it's more effective to give them, to make sure that the opportunities are there and that the system is support. I'm trying to talk like a political scientist. And I'm no good at that. But basically, we want them to be able to have fulfilling careers, to have like good wages and good income pre-tax. So it's a great thing for our tax system to make income, to redistribute income, to make things more equitable. That's absolutely an appropriate thing in my mind for a federal tax system to do. But that's not nearly enough. What we also really need to be focused on is getting people who have not seen the kinds of opportunities, or, you know, see fewer and fewer opportunities as the years go by, getting them the opportunities to succeed and to have really just fulfilling jobs and you know, live safely and productively.
Yeah, I think if, you know, if you go back to the start of our conversation when we were talking about, you know, the objectives of the Hamilton Project and indeed, you know, the real focus of CEDA, it is about, you know, I think a real belief that economic growth connected to as many people as possible is, you know, is what it's all about, isn't it? That it's not just growth for growth's sake, it's actually thinking about how you connect people to the opportunities and to allow them to, you know, lead fulfilling lives and to pursue, you know, to have decent well-being and all of those sorts of things. And it seems to be a pretty important conversation in the US right now.
Absolutely. And so it's a real, you know, if some policymakers are doing a better job at addressing those issues head on and offering more concrete solutions, you know, I can believe that would resonate with people. You know, and if other policymakers are trying to do that and just not connecting and not making the sale, that's a real problem.
Yeah. So look, here in Australia, certainly my friends and I have been sort of hanging on the election results and my colleagues as well. I mean, I cannot imagine what it's like actually sitting there in the US at the moment. So, you know, what is it like sitting there in Washington, D.C.? What does it feel like?
I am physically ill. It is making me physically ill. I am not the only one. I am just riddled with anxiety. It's a mess. It's a mess. This is, And it's not just, you know, what's going to happen in the next, you know, 5 hours, you know, am I going to understand the election results? It's also, what am I learning about the country? And where have different arguments resonated? And where are people, it's just, you know, seeing all of that, there's just, you know, evidence just hitting you smack in the face of all of these the task in front of us for how the U.S. is somehow going to repair itself as a country. I don't know, the task seems Herculean. I just want to hide under my bed.
Yeah. Well, I really don't envy you living in that environment. And as I said, even looking, you know, across the oceans from Australia, it's just, I think people are just really surprised and I guess hoping that somehow a path gets found to a more stable environment, if nothing else. Can I just, Wendy, also ask about, you know, how life with COVID in the US is feeling. Again, it's one of those things, we see a lot of it in the media. I think everyone in Australia is quite obsessed with numbers. Here in Victoria, where I live, you know, we're celebrating, I think it's 5 or 6 days in a row now of no COVID cases, having had 111 days of pretty severe lockdown, I have to say. But when you start getting what we call donut cases, it all seems worthwhile. And we're looking at the numbers in the US. One of the things that I personally just really don't have a sense of is how people are living their day-to-day lives. I mean, we talked earlier about the fact that, you know, you're actually relatively new to Brookings. You haven't actually been into the building. Can you just give me a couple of minutes on what life feels like over there? Is it sort of a de facto lockdown? I guess I'm kind of interested in what's actually going on.
I think one of the things that the answer to your question is going to reveal is one of the really big challenges right now for someone trying to advise policymakers, which is I don't really know because I just sit at home. And so I know how my family's doing. You know, when you talk about like a sort of a visceral sense, like a tactile sense of how people are doing, I know how my family's doing. I know how my neighborhood's doing. I have even a sense of how my community's doing. But like, I don't even know how the District of Columbia is doing because I live in a suburb of DC and I actually haven't walked through DC since March. And so I just have in a sense, the only reason I would know more than you is because I'm just reading more articles than you are. It's not that I have that much more of a tactile sense of how it's going. Now, I'm overstating it a little bit. Like, I've traveled a little bit. I've driven an hour or two away and taken hikes. And, you know, I sort of have a sense. But it's very weird trying to understand, for example, the economic challenges that we're facing when I don't know. I guess I hadn't realized before this crisis how much it, I don't know, like how much all of the collection of anecdotes in the course of a day or in the course of a week of walking down the street, seeing businesses closed, traveling around the country, seeing people, I don't know, lined up for, you know, this benefit or that, like how much those just collection of anecdotes would give a sense of whether or not an economy was doing well or poorly. I appreciate that none of that could take the place of data, but it did matter.
And yeah.
Yeah. Right now I'm basically, yeah, I feel like I'm as good as just having a brain in a box. Like I'm just, you know, I don't really have, cause I'm not like walking around learning much. But I am overstating it. I mean it. Like I've gone around a little bit, but yeah, I don't. The one thing I'll say is that for sure I see evidence that there's this massive disparity in how people are handling the virus. So there are some places where everybody's wearing masks, everybody's keeping distance from each other. You know, people are jogging and bicycling with masks, like tearing down.
Now that's committed.
That is very committed. So yeah, like watching somebody bike like 40 miles an hour, like racing down, like with a mask, very impressive. But then I have seen there are other parts of the country where I have to remind myself, like, isn't there a pandemic? Like, I see nobody, nobody acting in any way differently than, you know. So anyway, that I can for sure say I've seen.
I'm going to finish off on a fun fact, Wendy, if I can. So I want the secret sauce here. How on earth do you manage to turn a report on the financial crisis into a bestseller?
So first, I think we had a leg up because there was a lot of talk as the commission was doing its work that we were a little bit similar in spirit to the 9/11 commission. And of course we weren't, and there were a lot of reasons why we were different. But the 9/11 report was a big bestseller. Like people just devoured the 9/11 report. So that helped us in terms of attention, that, you know, people thought there were parallels there. But more substantively, we put a ton of energy into how we wrote it. We really wanted it to be readable. We imagined this being a resource for, you know, the typical interested American. This was not a report for experts. This was not a report for insiders. This was trying to explain the financial crisis to the American public. Anybody who had the energy to dig into this should be able to understand it. And so we brought a professional writer on board, and he was just spectacular. And he edited every word as we were going. So yeah, we got plaudits for that. Like people said, I can actually read this and understand this. So I think that helped us.
Well, Wendy, I'm going to take a leaf out of your book, I think, and see if I can persuade my bosses to get us to get a writer on board. We'll see how I can go with that. But it sounds like a plan. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Wendy. It's been an absolute pleasure. I hope things look up in the US. I hope that we get some resolutions quickly enough so that you can you know, get out of hibernation in more ways than one, and continue, I don't know, keep the rose-colored
glasses. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Now,
yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's been super to talk to you. Okay,
yeah,
bye-bye.
Great. Thanks. All the best, Wendy.